I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano, and from American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download, the show that helps you win your next dinner party.
Our icebreaker this week came from playwright...
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Ask any public radio listener, and chances are they have a favorite program they listen to on a daily or weekly basis. On occasion, we've had the honor of talking with some of your public radio favorites. First up, Dinner Party Download host Rico Galliano. The former Marketplace reporter spoke with us on three occasions. Our first conversation began with an explanation of Pittsburgh's connection to the dinner party.
I am from your fair city / my fair city of Pittsburgh. I went to junior high and high school in Mount Lebanon, and I went to Pitt from, what was that? Oh, man, should I even admit this?
Go ahead.
It was 87 to 91. I'm class of 91, and I miss it. Actually, very much. And my folks still live out there in Mount Lebanon, actually, so I do get back as often as I can.
What are your favorite memories of Pittsburgh and attending Pitt?
I was a DJ at WPTS, so, you know, I guess I got my radio start at Pitt. That's fairly important, so I owe my career to it. And actually, especially in retrospect, seeing some amazing shows at the Pitt Student Union and at David Lawrence Hall, I saw the band Pavement, sort of known as the granddaddy of indie rock, on what I think was their first national tour at Pitt Student Union, the DC band Unrest. And I do not miss having so little money that I would regularly have a single daily meal of hot dogs with chili from Sheetz.
How did the dinner party get started?
I was a reporter, as you mentioned, at Marketplace, the public radio business show, and my co-host Brendan Francis Noonan was a producer there. And we loved working on the show, but it's a business show, and we are followers of culture. And to talk about that kind of stuff that we loved on air, it had to be filtered through that lens of business, which isn't always the most fun way to talk about some of these things. So we kept thinking about what our ultimate show would be and hit upon this idea that it would be about everything that we like to talk about at dinner parties and that people would ask us about at dinner parties, because we're the kinds of people that people would ask about, you know, like, what music do you think is cool right now? What restaurant should I eat at? And so we came up with this idea of a short podcast that you could digest very quickly, no pun intended, that would have all the kind of stuff that you would want to talk about at a dinner party for people who are otherwise, say, too busy to take it all.
How were you able to get big names to consent to be interviewed for a podcast?
It's something that we built up over time, and it's not something that we definitely had a plan for, but what ended up happening is we started interviewing artists that we knew, many of whom were actually of some renown. I live out here in L.A., so we do meet some people that, you know, like indie musicians of some renown and people in cool indie bands, so we would interview those folk, and that gave us credibility with great indie artists that we didn't know. And then once people started listening to us in larger numbers, which happened actually pretty quickly, like we were named, when we first came on iTunes, we were named one of their best podcasts of the year, which really helped. And so once we could say that people were listening to us around the country, then we could go to bigger stars and say, look, there's this audience of very engaged culture goers that you can reach on our show. And I think it also helps that we have this reputation as a show where celebrities aren't necessarily going to be asked the same questions as everyone else asks. In fact, one of the questions that we ask all of our guests is, what question are you sick of getting asked? Which actually makes us, in addition to giving them a chance to vent about all the terrible interviews that they've been having, actually makes us, when we're preparing our questions, have to think about what that stupid question would be they wouldn't want to be asked, so that we have to ask better questions. So all of that, I think, has helped, Lynn.
Our second visit with Rico took place during Essential Pittsburgh's holiday special. We asked the host with the most what he's learned about hosting a dinner party.
Well, here's the dirty little secret of the dinner party. People often ask us for things like, you know, how should I set the table and all that kind of stuff. And it's really, the show is not about dinner parties. It sort of has the vibe of a dinner party. But really, the dinner party is just an organizational shtick to get to talk about whatever we want to talk about, which tends to be the kind of stuff you'd want to talk about at a dinner party, the arts, culture, humor.
Our thanks to Rico Galliano, host of the Dinner Party Download, heard Friday nights at 9 on 90.5 WESA. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, NPR's weekly news quiz show, is one of public radio's most popular programs. Essential Pittsburgh has talked with host Peter Sagal and panelists Paula Poundstone and Alonzo Bowden. We spoke with Paula prior to a stop in Pittsburgh and asked if being a panelist on the show is as much fun as it sounds.
It is. You know, if the others didn't cheat, it would be the perfect work experience.
How does it compare to other game shows you've done, like To Tell the Truth and Hollywood Squares?
I don't know. I mean, there is similarities in that I'm paid to sit in a chair and play a game and laugh, which just seems immoral. It's hardly work. And by the way, I think I lost at those other games as well. I am the big loser, not by design, but I tend to be the village idiot of the show. For those who don't know, it's a weekly news quiz show, and three panelists vie for the mantle of, you know, most informed, I guess, for the week. But we can say whatever we want, and the goal is to be entertaining and funny, I suppose. And so we are.
Well, of course, you've made a name for yourself doing stand-up, and you began back in 1979. How did you get your start?
I started doing open mic nights in Boston in 79, you know, where anybody who wanted to could go up for 5 minutes and tell their little jokes. You know, just sort of started practicing that way. And after, I don't know, not that long, several months, a year or something, I took a Greyhound bus around the country to see what clubs were like in different cities and ended up in San Francisco for a few years, you know, before I made my way down here to silly, stupid Southern California.
Now, did you know that stand-up comedy was what you wanted to do early on as a kid?
Yeah, I did. I don't think I knew that I would. And in fact, I maybe not stand-up per se. I think I had hoped to be like a comic actress because I was familiar, you know, especially with Lily Tomlin and Kel Burnett, you know, Myrtle Moore and Gilda Radner, those types. So I think I saw myself doing that somewhere. And then when stand-up comedy was sort of, what's the word?
In vogue?
Yeah, it kind of came back to life in the very late 70s. And I just so happened to be there right then. And so, you know, I kind of got in on the ground floor. I would still like to do comic acting at some point. I don't know. For now, I do this.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with comedian Paula Poundstone, known for, among other things, her appearances on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Paula, you have been out there on the road for a long time. What makes you want to keep doing the one-night stands and traveling and all the stuff that goes along with that?
It really is just the greatest experience. I get to go be with a group of people and, you know, laugh for a couple hours, you know, at night. I get to, you know, anything that happens to me, no matter how badly it goes, I know in the back of my mind that I get to go tell it on stage somewhere and, you know, sort of squeeze the, you know, the essential oils from it, get the part that we all relate to and you know, you'll tell it to somebody else and you'll get that recognition laughter. It's a great job. I couldn't be happier that I get to do this, and I have the best crowds. Now I work, it's just me on the show. I don't have anybody else on with me. But in the old days when I worked clubs and they would have a, you know, a headliner and an opener and an MC, guys would kill to work with me. And not because it's such a stroll in the park to be around me, but because they wanted to talk to my audience. I'm hoping to achieve incontinence in audience members. I'm hoping that, you know, that people laugh really, really hard. I hope that they come away at least with having neared incontinence and also, with sore faces.
Comedian Paula Poundstone has been my guest. You can hear her on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me every Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to noon right here on 90.5 WESA. Paula, it has been great having you on Essential Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for visiting with us.
Well, thanks very much. And I love Pittsburgh. Great place.
Clark. acclaimed comedian and winner of NBC's Last Comic Standing, Alonzo Bowden. Known as a thinking man's stand-up comedian, Mr. Bowden has been a regular on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and his one-hour comedy special, Who's Paying Attention, premiered on Showtime as the second highest-rated special in the history of the network. We live in interesting times, and there doesn't seem to be any shortage of material, does there?
No, definitely not. I love to do topical stuff, and it truly is an unending well. I mean, it still is that way, where the news cycle is so fast as to what's important, and then it goes away, and you just like, well, move on. What happened? I don't know. Move on. So. It's fun to try to figure out what people are talking about and why.
I mentioned that you have earned a reputation as a thinking man's comedian. Explain your process for developing the kind of material that you perform.
Well, it's and thank you for that. The highest compliment I ever got was Playboy magazine. One of their writers called me a spawn of Carlin.
And spawn of Carlin.
Yeah, I think there were three great comedians. Like, the three best would be Cosby, Pryor, and Carlin. And you fall into one of those schools, right? So Carlin was a guy who talked topical and what was going on. And what I talk about, where it comes from, is what outrages me. What's ridiculous in the news? Or where are we missing the point? Like now, the NSA scandal, right? And the NSA is listening in on your phone calls. No, they're not. You know why? Because you're boring. Because you're an average American. You have nothing to say. You know what I mean? It's like you're not Jason Bourne. No one's listening in on your personal. And then the other side of it is we have social media. Like, we're begging people to listen in on, please look at my lunch. You know, look at a picture of the new car I bought. Like, we're begging people, look at me, look at me, look at me. The government's looking at you. It's an outrage. So that's where it comes from. It just and again, it's unending how much of that goes on, and I just see it, and I talk about it, and then a bunch of people laugh, and I'm like, hey, I'm on to something.
How did you get into doing stand-up?
That's a great question. I was an aerospace mechanic, and I did that for 10 years, and then I started training new mechanics, and I liked making them laugh. Like, I always had a sense of humor. I could always joke about stuff, but I didn't know I could do it in front of people until I started teaching. And when you're standing there, especially in aerospace, where some things are so droll, I remember we had one lesson that was 8 hours on fasteners, okay? Bolts, rivets, screws, etc. Now, you couldn't get more boring than trying to explain part numbers of different fasteners. So I ended up telling a lot of jokes and being funny, and I was like, hey, I like this, you know? And I had friends living in L.A. I had friends in the entertainment business, and they were like, go for it. So
you were working for Lockheed Martin.
I worked at Lockheed, McDonnell Douglas. I've been laid off from every defense company we have. But at that time I was at McDonnell Douglas, but yeah.
Right. So you make this leap of faith into something that is somewhat
risky.
Well,
it's not a leap of faith. When you're in aerospace, you just wait till you get laid off because you know it's coming. I did a comedy writing class. I did my first 5 minutes. And I was absolutely hooked. And I was in the process. I knew I was getting laid off. And I made a deal with myself to never work on airplanes again. I said, no, I'm just going to pursue. Because if I'd gone back to working on airplanes, I would have been making a comfortable living. And I wouldn't have devoted myself to comedy. So I said, don't look back. Just pursue comedy. And I did. And it took a few years. It took 4 years before I became a full-time comic, which was relatively quick. I was lucky. I got a big break with the Comedy Festival in Montreal, which is the biggest one in the world. It's called Just for Laughs, and I got discovered there, and that's when I went full-time, and it's been great ever since. But that's how I started, and yeah, it was definitely a leap of faith, and it was tough at times. I did some crazy jobs to pay the rent.
Like what?
The craziest one was painting addresses on curbs in front of houses. I did that.
It's amazing how an artist has to support himself.
You do what you got to do because you want to get on stage. You want to, you know, that's – comedy is different than – I have friends who are musicians and I have friends who are actors. But comedy is the thing that you can't practice anywhere else but on stage. There's no studio. There's no acting class, that you have to be on stage in front of people. The only way you get any good is actually doing it.
Who were the stand-up comedians who had the strongest influence on you?
To this day, Bill Cosby is still the greatest, in my opinion, the greatest comic who's ever. I mean, I just saw Cosby 2 weeks ago, and a bunch of us comics went to see him, and we just shake our heads like, wow, how does he do that? His storytelling, his writing is great. He was an influence. George Wallace was a great influence, and he's become a great friend, which is very
George Wallace,
cool.
The comedian.
The comedian, yeah. Robin Harris, who died tragically young before a lot of people knew who he was so quick. I always admired that. He was ready for anything. So I always thought he was great. Lewis Black, you know, when it comes to politics, Lewis Black is an influence. Chris Rock. Yeah, Chris Rock somewhat, you know, again, topical and strong. And, of course, George Carlin. And that was one of the great things. I did get to work with Carlin before he passed away. That was phenomenal. Carlin, definitely. I mean, he had a saying. He said he would take people across the line and make them glad they came.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is comedian Alonzo Bowden. You managed to get a lot of mileage out of making jokes about Sarah Palin.
Oh, everyone did. She just had this folksy opinion based on nothing that people bought into, partly because a big part of it was because they hated Barack Obama so much. Now, to me, the beauty of the United States of America is that we could create Sarah Palin and Barack Obama at the same time. I mean, they're only about 5 or 6 years apart, meaning they grew up in the same era in this country. And look at the two extremes, and both of them somehow considered by some people, and I'm certainly not one of them, but somehow equal. You know, constitutional professor from Harvard and a community college dropout from Alaska are somehow both considered like, yeah, they could, either one of them could run the country. What? but we did that. But again, that's the level of diversity in America, right? That's what makes our country great and ridiculous at the same time.
You're a regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, as I mentioned. What do you enjoy about being on that show?
I love that show. That show is so much fun. Peter Sagal is probably one of the smartest people I've ever met. And when he talks and brings up these topics and talks about them, and like he has writers, but his main writer is him, you know, and that there'll always be something on that show that they will ask me about that I will sit there blank and I have no idea. That's my favorite moment of the show. I have no idea what you're talking about right now. No, I can't answer that. And the panelists are great. This week I'm with Paula Poundstone and Jesse Klein. This was a show with three different comics and three completely different style of comics doing the show. I met Tom Baudet on the show. I had no idea that he wrote books. I thought he just did Motel 6 commercials. I was like, wait a minute, you do something else? So yeah, it's a fun show, and the topics are fun. I think that's what I like, that you have to be funny about something that just happened that I just heard about. I love that.
It's
a creative challenge that, yeah, it's great.
And it plays to your strengths.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's fun.
And you can hear Alonzo Bowden on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on Saturday and Sunday mornings at 11. He's been our guest here in Studio A. Alonzo Bowden, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Paul. This was great. I really had fun doing this.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our special program featuring conversations with public radio personalities continues. We spoke with This American Life host, Ira Glass, right after the program received its fourth Peabody Award for what the presenters called a show which, quote, captures contemporary culture in fresh and inventive ways that mirror the diversity and eccentricities of its subjects and weaves original monologues, mini-dramas, original fictions, traditional radio documentaries, and original radio dramas into an instructional and entertaining tapestry. We began our conversation by asking Ira if he felt This American Life was reinventing radio.
Well, I mean, it's not like I don't have the sense that like we've reinvented something and it's caught on like wildfire and everybody's doing it for sure. But I think to make the show I and the producers I was working with, like we did try to reinvent, like, well, what do you do in an hour of radio? And try to redesign it so it would be, you know, chattier, and that it would be stories, that it would be, you know, this thing that radio does so well, which is, you know, having somebody tell a compelling story, but do it in a way that would seem contemporary and not like, you know, old 1940s, you know, radio serials or something.
The first episode of This American Life aired in November of 1995 under the show's original title, which was Your Radio Playhouse. What was different about those early episodes, if anything?
It's funny because I was just listening to the very first episode to pull a clip of tape for a project the other day. I mean, what it's like is we hadn't really decided as a staff on like what would be in and what would be out. So there was a lot more experimentation. And I think like it took a year or so, I think, like with any show, for us to kind of fall into a sense of like, this is the stuff we do better than anything else, and these other things are things that we're going to leave out. So the first year or two of the show has some real highs, but it also has some real weird stuff in there too.
What was the initial reaction, audience reaction to the show?
I mean, the actual like radio audience reaction was pretty positive from the beginning. You know, with a couple of question marks, like one of the ongoing question marks for years has been me and the voices of the other hosts, like there was of the other contributors, like we'd have a contributor like Sarah Vowell or David Sedaris. And if people have heard them on the radio, like they don't have traditional radio voices at all. And in fact, almost no one on the show had a kind of traditional sort of radio performance voice. And now we've been on the air so long, I feel like people are used to it and it's old hat. But the fact that I was hosting the show in the style I was, I mean, I had been an NPR reporter and a producer for All Things Considered and Morning Edition. And I just remember like a lot of the program directors around the country who we were trying to convince to pick up the radio show, like they would hear the show and they'd say like, oh, well, Ira's a really good reporter and obviously a very good producer. But like, are you going to get a host? Like, can you afford a real host? And truthfully, like, we couldn't afford somebody like who, you know, would sound more like Robert Siegel. And the way that I was talking on the air was intentional. You know, I mean, I actually had to train myself out of sounding like an NPR reporter, which I used to sound like just all the other NPR reporters with this sort of more formal presentational style. And I tried to train myself to sound, again, just the way I speak when I'm really speaking, because I thought it just gets through to you more effectively, especially with these stories that are more emotional. And funnier. Like it seemed weird to be doing a more formal kind of newsy presentation with stories that are so full of feeling. We got a kind of general good vibe of like, oh, somebody's trying something new. Let's hear that. And also like, wait a second, somebody's trying something new. But the stories that tend to be my favorites, I feel like tend to be the ones that are the audiences that we hear from the audience too, you know, like, and they often are the big ambitious things we try. Like several weeks ago, we spent two episodes at this high school where they had 29 shootings in the previous year, 8 deaths of current and recent students. And we posted 3 reporters there for 5 months and just to document what it's like in a place where you know, there's so many shootings and what people in that situation know about that kind of violence and the aftermath of it that the rest of us don't. And I feel like, you know, my relationship to that was in a way the same as the listeners, where like I didn't know a lot about what it's like. And it was interesting to hear how super competent the staff of this public high school was, where they, you know, when they would hear about, you know, one shooting, we watched them kind of jump into action, trying to prevent a retaliation shooting and trying to protect their kids and doing just super competent staff in a very, very difficult situation. And so I feel like, you know, those are the episodes that I feel like are the ones that are the most exciting to me, the ones that take me somewhere that I've never been and couldn't have imagined. There's ones we did on an aircraft carrier that was flying missions over Afghanistan, sending missions over Afghanistan. You know, the shows that we did inside Iraq during the Iraq War, same thing. The whole staff is so good at their jobs and everybody does such a good job. You know, the people who I work with, I feel like the quality of the show has never been higher. like there are more great stories and fewer just good stories.
Ira Glass is the host of This American Life. Ira Glass, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is hosted by Peter Sagal and features official judge and scorekeeper Carl Castle. The show is heard by more than 3 million listeners on nearly 630 NPR member stations, including WESA on Saturdays and Sundays at 11 a.m. We spoke with Peter Sagal earlier this year when he was promoting the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me live high-definition version of the program that was shown on the big screen. We asked Peter why they were doing a cinematic version of the radio show.
Basically, we're doing it to try to appease my unappeasable ego. I just demand more and more attention. I'm like that. We're all like that in public radio, as I'm sure you know, Paul. we're going to pretend it's in 3D, so every now and then we will rush at the camera in a threatening way, hoping to make people shriek. Well, our show, and some of your listeners might have seen us when we came to Pittsburgh some years ago and did the show there with your then-governor. People may remember that we're not perhaps the most cinematic of people. I have a face made for radio, but it is a lot of fun, our live shows. The main appeal, I think, in addition to this time to the music and the set and the film we'll be showing, is that we do a lot more stuff on stage than ever gets broadcast. And most of the stuff that we don't broadcast is fairly raunchy. So if this is sort of like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me after dark. So, difference, yes. It's like you know, slightly more with our tie slightly loosened. Maybe this is public radio.
Well, there have been rumors that Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me might find its way to TV. Is this maybe a first step toward that?
No. This is, although you never know. I imagine if everybody in America is Trump's down, maybe this will start a movie career for us. Maybe this will be, you know, the next summer tent pole, as they say, is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me live. And I will be played by Tom Cruise.
I thought Stanley Tucci would be the guy.
Well, you know, basically what happened is, as we've been sitting here, I'm going, why not go for it? Why? People don't know what I look like, and at least they won't until the second. So why not dream big? And the advantage for Tom Cruise is he won't have to wear lifts. We're about the same height.
Do you worry that this event might take away from the pleasant radio theater of the mind that you've established with listeners?
I think the worst problem is everybody has this sort of pleasant image of what I and my friends look like. And once you actually see us, I mean, we're basically going to have to spend the first 10 minutes of this cinecast just killing time, because no one will be listening to us. They'll just be staring at the screens and going, my God, is that what they look like? And that's, you know, once you've lost that innocence, you can't get it back. And I warn people that if you want to think of me as, you know, whoever you want to think of me as, then you don't come. But if you actually want to see how we do the show and how much fun it is, and to see some of your favorite people like Tom Baudet and Mo Rocca and Paula Poundstone and Steve Martin and those people, and Carl Castle, of course, live on stage, and you don't want to make a long trip to Chicago, this is the best way to do it.
Well, we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, it's been 15 years since you started Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and I'm curious what you think the secret of the success has been.
I think we get to say the things on the radio that most people just shout at the radio. And that's very important, I think, in public radio, which is often very polite and measured and restrained, as our listeners are. But once a week, we get to act juvenile and silly and hoot and guffaw and mock people who are much more important than we are. And I think people need that. I think it restores a sense of equilibrium to their universe, and they're able to go through the rest of their week being serious again. It's sort of the equivalent of like going into a big bouncy castle and jumping around for a while, and it sort of wears you out and lets you go back to your job.
And as far as the future of the program, what directions do you want to take it?
I think I'd love to get, you know, more and more interesting guests. We've been expanding into talking to like scientists and people who have really interesting areas of knowledge. We're continuing to do that. And, you know, I just want to continue to respond as sharply and as wittily as we can to the events of the events of news, because that's not getting any less weird, and we just need to keep upping our game.
Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, thank you so much for joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and hello to everybody in Pittsburgh.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Susan Page is the Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today. She's also a frequent guest host on The Diane Rehm Show. During a visit to Pittsburgh to take part in a Post-Gazette panel discussion on the 2012 presidential election, she stopped by the WESA studios. At the time, the big news story out of Washington was the fiscal cliff. In this excerpt from our interview, you'll find her remarks about the bipartisan gridlock in D.C. to be prescient.
Well, of course, the fiscal cliff forces some of these issues, forces the political leaders in Washington to come to a deal or live with the consequences, which would be, most economists think, pretty serious for the state of the economy and the recovery. But things will happen if they don't reach a deal. And that's why I think that many analysts in Washington think that a deal is likely to be made before the end of the year. You know, the polarization that we've seen in Washington has been very frustrating to a lot of Americans when they see things not getting done and so much partisan fighting. And I guess I don't see where that ends anytime soon. The parties have very different views of the biggest issues and what ought to be done about those issues. And it's been a recipe for gridlock the last 2 years. And I'd like to be optimistic after this long campaign that some of those are going to get resolved. But I'd have to say, I think you'd have to count me as a skeptic about that.
You mentioned the long campaign, and it won't be long before we're starting to ramp up to 2016. Do campaigns last too long in the United States?
I think you ask somebody in Ohio, they would say, yes, campaigns last too long, and there's too much money in them, and there's too many campaign ads. On the other hand, it's such an important job that this is, you know, this is our system. We have a system where candidates have to get through that primary process that tends to pull them to the extremes, pull them to the left if they're a Democrat, to the right if they're a Republican. We have a general election that, in fact, doesn't act too long. We've had something very positive happen in the last few elections, and that is the institutionalization of these presidential debates. You know, we haven't had presidential debates every year, every 4 years in our system. I think that's become a given for candidates. We've had three for each of the past two campaigns. That's when a lot of voters tuned in. It's when a lot of voters made up their mind about which candidates to support. That's one of the good things I see coming out of this last campaign.
How about the role that newspapers play in the campaign, particularly in this day and age of social media and the 24-hour news cycle? Things get posted early and often, and oftentimes before you have a chance to put a really well-researched, vetted article in print that someone may or may not read the next day because, well, I've already heard about that.
It's definitely a new world here for the news media. And, you know, these days you get a big scoop. You put it out on Twitter first. Then maybe you do a blog posting with a little more detail. That's for Twitter, of course, 140 characters. That's what you're limited to in a tweet. Then maybe you do a blog posting with a little more information, and then hopefully do a story that has more context and meaning that would appear in the newspaper and on the website. We're all dealing with this changed world in the best way that we can to try to keep voters informed and also to provide some added value so they know if they go and read a story on a website or in a newspaper, they're going to learn some things they didn't know. They're going to have it put in a context and some history that enables them to understand it and interpret it in a better way.
What keeps you hungry to find facts and also to interpret and reinterpret them for voters who are maybe not paying attention as much as you are because it's your job to do that, and who may be tuning in late or reading something late and, you know, haven't been paying attention?
You know, Americans are busy, especially these days. And I understand that. I mean, in some ways, I feel like I'm representing them when I go out to a story to distill it into something that they can read on the run or hear about on the run and come to a greater understanding about. I do a lot of the stories that we do about the USA Today Gallup poll, so I talk to poll respondents. And I am always impressed by how much Americans care about what's going on, how informed they are, even if they don't follow every single incremental development, and how much they care about this country.
Is USA Today better positioned to adapt to the changes of the future than other newspapers?
You know, I think as a national newspaper, for all those reasons that go back to its founding, and also because USA Today is a national newspaper, it's well positioned in this changing media environment. I certainly hope it is. You know, we try to be a newspaper that brings Americans who are busy and curious, information about the nation and the world in a way they can understand it and in a way they can read it and also live their busy lives.
Susan Page is Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today, joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh. Susan, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Paul.
NPR President and CEO Gary Nell brought strong leadership in a rapidly changing media environment due to his ability to drive cross-platform journalism and cultural programming throughout NPR's extensive network of member stations, including WESA. He visited the station this past summer, and we asked him what role he saw NPR playing in modern media.
Well, I think it's the importance of public radio, and as news and journalism have changed in America, and we're really finding a very challenging newspaper market and cable news, which is turned into something that's not quite news but mostly opinion. There's a very important case to be made for journalism, and I want to talk about that. And I also want to talk about the importance of public radio's music and art space, where we really are the megaphone, I think, for the cultural discovery and the cultural scene across the country that's really been abandoned in many ways by commercial media. The question is, you know, how do we make sure that people understand the difference between opinion and journalism? And when I talk about journalism, this is really about an attempt to tell facts. It's an attempt to make sure that they're fact-checked, that they're edited, they're sourced, that when you make a claim, there's actually some factual basis behind the claim, and to get at the truth. So whether it's a political figure or it's someone in the community who's making a claim, to make sure that, in fact, that person is being asked the right questions that they should be asked, and so people can make up their own minds about important, complex issues of the day. That's what public radio is about. It's really trying to provide a civil dialogue about the complex issues that folks in Pittsburgh and across the country are grappling with.
What is NPR doing to develop the talent and the programming of the future?
Well, this is a really important question. And look, part of what I'm trying to do at NPR is diversify our audience. I think the country's going through huge demographic shifts. I don't have to tell your listeners that. They see it every day. We need to do better ethnically and racially with different audiences than we've done in the past. We need to make sure geographically we're getting out of Washington more and listening to voices in western Pennsylvania and around the country. From an age point of view, getting younger people engaged who may have not been strapped into their car seats, being forced to listen to Morning Edition as kids. This is really important. So the first-time college graduate who's never heard of NPR, I think, is the person we want to aim at to engage around our programming.
Is there more of a burden on NPR with its foreign bureaus and reporters strategically placed around the world to provide international coverage?
Well, I think we are, you know, we carry that burden, I think, by choice. We have 18 foreign bureaus when everyone else, the major news networks and the CBSs and the NBCs have way cut back. The newspapers who used to be all over the world are completely cut back. They might have one office in London, maybe. And we're now expanding our coverage into Latin America. We are covering all over the Middle East. This is part of what makes NPR special and different. And having someone on the ground in Cairo to understand what the overthrow of the Mubarak regime was all about is really a much more in-depth understanding, or what's happening in Afghanistan. We still have 64,000 troops in Afghanistan. Who is talking about this other than National Public Radio? And the fact that we do have reporters like Sean Carberry in Kabul who are telling the stories of our troops over there is really important for all of us as Americans to understand, and especially as they come back to our country and have a big veteran set of coverage in Pittsburgh and around the country. This is what we can do, is to carry and cover the issues that are really important for the American people to engage around, and who I believe they want to engage around, but they don't have access to these things as newspapers get into tough situations and as commercial radio really has pulled out of coverage almost completely. reasons. We are very committed to our coverage and around foreign coverage, around science, around Washington and politics and veterans and science and health and education, the environment, energy. We're doing a lot covering hydraulic fracturing in Pennsylvania and all of the issues wrapped up around that. So we are committed to journalism, and we have, you know, 400 or so folks in our newsroom doing radio and digital journalism. We're going to keep at it.
I'm going to try to jam a couple more questions here into the less than 2 minutes we have
left.
It's
the lightning round.
Yes, CPB funding has been cut. If smaller stations in rural areas that don't have the audience to support their operations and programming cannot afford NPR, what happens to public radio, and what happens to those rural NPR stations?
Well, it's important that we have universal coverage, and what we mean by that is that, you know, every part of America, as much as we possibly can, are covered. You know, public radio is a system of some 900 stations. They're not controlled by NPR. NPR gets no direct federal funding. It's really all about having local community stations like WESA and hundreds of others across the country. So it's important for communities to get together and support their local stations.
Gary Nell, thanks so much for taking the time to join us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
We hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Essential Pittsburgh. You can catch the entire show online at WESA.FM or as a podcast in iTunes. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thank you for listening.